You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
It started on May 27th when a small group of people began a sit-in in a well-known, historically important park in Istanbul, Turkey. Their intent, to prevent the uprooting of some trees. On May 31st, the police launched a powerful attack with water cannon and tear gas guns to try and evict this handful of people. But instead, what had been a small crowd morphed quickly into a large, animated gathering of people of diverse backgrounds and differing outlooks. And what was happening in Istanbul was magnified by similar responses in cities across Turkey. The Prime Minister, Recep Erdogan, immediately denounced the demonstrators as looters and plunderers and threatened dire consequences, and the tensions kept building. To learn why this conflict developed as it did and what has happened since last night, when it seemed heading to a climax, we have contacted Barış Karacic. He is a lecturer in international development studies at Trent University in Ontario. Good morning, Barış, and a warm welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio and the Red Eye program.
Good morning. Thank you.
It's now evening in your homeland in Turkey. What can you tell us about the current situation in Istanbul and elsewhere in Turkey?
Well, in Istanbul, things had been quiet for a few days. But in other parts of Turkey, they have not been quiet. For example, last night in Ankara, there were many clashes. And based on what I've read this morning, another person lost his life, which makes it now five deaths since the beginning of the event on the 31st of May. And one of them is a police officer who fell off a bridge and died. In Istanbul, people are waiting until tomorrow, because tomorrow is an important day. There will be a meeting, there will be a mass rally organized by the governing AKP party. And until the meeting, or by the meeting, by the rally, the PM today made it clear that he's expecting everyone to evacuate the park. And maybe I should go a little bit back. 2 days ago, the representatives of the demonstrators from the park in Taksim, or in Istanbul, it's a central part of the city, met with Prime Minister Erdogan. And they had four demands. One of them is that they wanted the park to remain as a park, so that there would be no construction of a barracks, as well as a shopping mall. And the PM said the government will wait for the verdict of a court, because there's a court process that has been going on since the 31st of May. And he made it clear that the government will respect the decision of the court. Secondly, the representatives demanded investigations into the deaths and injuries that have taken place since the beginning of the plan. Again, the Prime Minister said investigations have already started, and a few police officers are being prosecuted. Thirdly, the representatives, they demanded the release of the demonstrators who have been detained, but they received no response from the Prime Minister. And again, the fourth demand was the creation of spaces in all squares in Turkey where the public could express itself freely. Again, there was no response. So they seemed to get two of their demands met, but the two other very important demands received no response. And today, there have been a few forums since this meeting took place, and the demonstrators in Taksim, they decided collectively in a democratic way to continue to resist. But at a rally that took place in Ankara today, The Prime Minister made it very clear. If you do not evacuate that park by tomorrow evening, we will do what is necessary to evict you. So this is the current situation.
Prime Minister Erdogan has been a very successful politician. He's led his party to three consecutive electoral victories to give them a large majority in the assemblies. How do you explain then that at least initially he was totally aggressive in his response to what started out as a small environmental protest in late May?
I think it is too early to say anything about this in terms of what led him to take such an aggressive stance towards this issue. Because when we go back to 27th of May, between 27th of May and 31st of May, the people in the park did not, the number was not more than 50 or 60. These were a group of environmentalists who opposed the tearing down of the trees in the park. But what triggered this series of events is the sheer police brutality that started on the 31st of May. And you explained it, you described it very clearly, that they even burned the tents of these demonstrators. And this triggered this series of events and demonstrations. But in my opinion, it is a last drop. So people said, enough. And there was a response, in my opinion, to a number of issues. This includes the aggressive foreign policy stance that the government has taken towards the Syrian conflict, which culminated with the bombing in a border town and killing more than 50 people. And secondly, the continuous and constant neoliberalization of Turkish society and assault on labor and its rights. But more importantly, in the context of these events, is the attempts by the government, above all, the prime minister, to impose a certain way of life, a social discipline on Turkish society, which is quite diverse and divided along ethnic, political, cultural lines.
And what kind of examples would you give then of this goal of imposing, as you phrase it, social discipline?
For example, from last week, it's a very recent one. The president signed a bill that bans the sale of alcohol between outside though. From stores, etc., between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. Turkish society had never experienced anything like this. Another one is the interference, for example, with public displays of affection. A couple was, was actually there was city employees interfering when two couples were kissing on public transit. These might sound very minor things, but when you add them up, in the past 10 years, there's a perceived threat to secularism in Turkey, as well as a perceived imposition, and it's a real one, actually, of a particular social discipline on the rest of Turkish society.
Maybe we can go into this a little bit more. I'm sure you're very familiar that in Western imperial culture, the word Islam evokes a dark hole of ignorance, rigid stereotypes, becomes an object of fear and hostility. What would you say is the cultural concept of Islam in Turkey? Not in relation to Erdogan himself, but among the population as a whole.
Well, in Turkey, as in other predominantly Muslim countries, there are, we can talk of various Islams or different groups of Muslims. In Turkey, we have a core group of really conservative Muslims, but we have also a huge group of secular Muslims and who have been trying to defend this concept of secularism. But at the same time, I have to make it very clear that Turkish secularism was borrowed from the French. And when we look at the history of the Republic since the early 1920s, the way it has been implemented, it's a very rigid understanding of secularism. And actually, this explains to a great extent why there was such a reaction towards that concept as well as the Republic by this group of conservative Muslims in Turkey. But if they had been victimized to some extent until 10 years ago, the irony is that now they're victimizing or turning into the secular segments of society into victims in a way. I don't want to sound too sensational, but we've been witnessing this process.
There were some people saying that one of Erdogan's ambitions is to transform the political system into a presidential style of government, in which he as president would have much more authority and power than he might have had in these last periods when he's been serving as a prime minister with another person as president.
That is definitely one of his intentions. But it will be what he has in mind is a presidential system in which those checks are rather weak, which alarms many people, many democratic forces in the country. But he doesn't have the two-thirds majority in the parliament. And we don't know yet, because we don't have enough evidence to make a conclusive statement, assertion, argument about this. But this was, I think, and many people would agree with me, one of the important issues that was discussed with the Kurdish movement 2 months ago. So the government most likely promised the Kurds some a number of political and cultural rights in exchange for their support in the parliament for a presidency, a constitutional amendment that would bring a presidency. But again, it is too early to say something conclusive about this.
You mentioned neoliberal economic policies. There were certainly, prior to the successes of the Erdogan party in gaining majorities over the last 10 years, there were a lot of economic crises and difficulties. Has the government gained credibility because its neoliberal policies have been without great crisis up to this point?
When the AKP came to power in 2002, they had basically two promises. They made two promises. One of them was the democratization, and the AKP has referred to their program as advanced democracy, whatever that means. And secondly, they promised stability. Turkey had just experienced a severe financial crisis before that election. And when you look at the last 10 years, yes, Turkey has not, and it's been a rather a stable Turkish economy, and there has not been a major crisis. But on the other hand, it looks like, when you look at the indicators, it looks like Turkey has been able to rather postpone that crisis, and mostly through debt. When you look at the statistics and when you compare them, there have been huge increases in different forms of debt since the in the last decade in Turkey. But the fact is that the Turkish economy has not gone through a major crisis, and this is one of the reasons why the popular support behind AKP has been quite significant. And in the last elections in 2011, they came to power with 50% of the votes.
So looking at the people who are in the squares now in Istanbul and Ankara and other Turkish major cities, are there characteristics they have which indicate some sort of political or ideological unity, or are they really quite diverse and new to that notion of ideologies?
That's a very good question. At the same time, it's a very complex. The answer would be quite. It's not easy to answer the question. But until now, this has emerged as a popular uprising, uniting different and diverse groups within society, including middle classes, some parts of labor, different ethnicities, against an increasingly authoritarian and a neoliberal government. But it's difficult to talk about a unity when you look at the programs, when you look at the the people that form this these groups as well as this movement. So it's quite diverse. Well, on the one hand, you see Kurds organized under the Peace and the Democracy Party, the BDP. On the other hand, you see many Kemalists, followers of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who founded the Republic in the 1920s. You see many other people who are not affiliated with any political organization or association. But there's one important thing, and that is very, very significant. What Erdogan has achieved, or has been very successful at doing in the last 18 days, is that he politicized hundreds of thousands of people who used to be apolitical. Because after the military takeover in 1980, there was a process of depoliticization that was implemented by the state of Turkish society. But in the last 17, 18 days, what we've seen is complete politicization of these formerly apolitical people. And that is a very remarkable process. And this is, in my opinion, the greatest contribution of Erdogan as the prime minister of our country.
And you say that with a smile, I assume. It's not something he would welcome.
No, absolutely. Of course, he would not welcome that. But it is difficult to foresee, predict what will unfold. Even tomorrow, we don't know. But this process of politicization, in my opinion, might contribute to a further democratization of society, or at least it might contribute to a strengthening that more democratic, a more progressive opposition to the AKP government. Because although it seems like the GDP has increased, it seems like there's some stability. The AKP government has brought very little, if any, to the working masses of this country.
You mentioned in passing earlier a reference to Syria, the conflict there, and the Erdogan government's role in that. Certainly, it seems from afar that one of Erdogan's ambitions is to make Turkey the dominant power in the region. How would you assess his relations with the other countries, whether it's Iraq, Iran, and Syria? What has he made progress in establishing himself as a point of reference and leadership in the region?
I don't think that's what has happened under the AKP government. When you look at the foreign policy, the early foreign policy of the AKP government, you can see an emphasis on zero problems policy, zero problems with Turkey's neighbors policy. But this has not been the case. The government has completely failed to achieve that goal. Now, Turkey has problems with both Iran and Syria, and it's not quite friendly with Iraq either. So it has been a complete failure. So what Erdogan has tried to do, and many people who are critical of his foreign policy and his party's foreign policy, is that he's followed a policy of what, as we call it, of neo-Ottomanism, which means he wanted to increase the influence of Turkey over those territories that used to be under Ottoman rule. When I say Ottoman rule, I'm referring to the Ottoman Empire, which used to be the dominant power in the Middle East for a few centuries. But the leading figure behind this policy is an intellectual, actually, a former professor of international relations called Davutoğlu, who is the current foreign minister right now. But Turkey has completely failed to achieve that goal. And the Syrian case is a very good proof of that.
Well, we could talk much more, but I want to thank you very much, Barış, for your time today. And I hope in future we can call on you for analysis of further developments in your homeland.
I will be very happy to do that. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our guest has been Barış Karacic. He is a lecturer in international development studies in Trent University in Ontario.